I planned to do an experiment for you today, but a 9-volt battery has gotten in the way. So Lauren is off at Mujo trying to find a 9-volt battery, and we'll try to get some ganglia recordings over break. It's a little bit more involved than the last one, and we'll see if it works or not. So this is my last series of lectures for you guys on neurophysiology. So the fourth one's going to be on the electrode problem. Now the last, I guess, four lectures, I've talked about all the wonderful things you can do with electrodes and amplifiers and expensive data analysis machines, but I have alluded to this thing called the electrode problem. And the electrode problem, what do you think it is? That's one electrode problem. fMRI is helping that. That's another part of the electrode problem. Anybody else have a suggestion? Immune response, which will ultimately lead to For neuroprosthetics, which I'll spend the last bit of this 2 hours talking about, to become a viable reality, you need to be able to record brain signal a period of at least 2 to ideally 10 years. Now, if I'm sticking little nails or wires in your brain is very good and your whole body is very good at recognizing a foreign object and will attack it. So in a series of experiments, if you go into LBME or Gerstacker and start implanting a bunch of animals, you'll notice that some of your electrodes will lose their signal within 2 to 10 weeks, and you might have the one or two animals that last out to a year. And why this occurs, why some electrodes last for a year or two, and why some fail within 2 weeks, is an issue of pointed research. A lot of people over the last 5 years have recognized that this needs to be a problem that needs to be solved, and it's a tough problem. And again, so this is an exemplary recording, so 382 days, but this should be the minimum that an electrode should work, not the maximum that you brag about to all your colleagues, and you can't explain why this particular rat had electrodes signals for over a year. You can see in the four animals in this top study, they got unit activity up to 25 weeks and up to 52 weeks. But still, for pacemakers, cochlear implants, artificial hips, all the things that give us biomedical engineer salaries, we need to solve this problem. Here's another study from, you can see the same thing, 2 to 18 weeks. Some fail immediately. Some will seem to last a longer bit of time. But again, why this is, no one knows. The people are trying to begin to understand it. So you can imagine, quite simply, if I stick a nail in your head, you're eventually going to get some sort of immune response that results in glia and astrocytes coating your electrode, increasing the impedance, and also separating the neural sources that you're trying to record from your electrode sites. People are trying, usually the fields of systems electrophysiology and molecular biology do not overlap, though they are beginning to, with two or three labs and ever increasing every year, trying to look at the cascade of molecular events, the result in day one being able to get signal to who knows when, the glial response taking over and you losing your ability to chronically record. So I'm not going to stand up here and tell you the solution to the problem because it's not known yet. But I will begin to talk about some ways we can mitigate the electrode problem, a series of incremental improvements in electrode design that may ultimately lead to the 5-year implant. So this is work done here at UM by John Seymour. What he has done here is used solid state MEMS technology is he's made a probe with a very unique architecture. You can see he's got a thick silicon dioxide shank, but his actual electrode sites are on these wings. The idea being if you make the electrode sites on features of the electrode small enough to the subcellular scale that you may have a reduced immune response on the wings less so than the main shank used for penetrating the brain. And what's curious about the electrode problem is that the variability is all over the place. This is an example from that same electrode. You can see that there are three types of stains. The blue is for hoaxed. Does anybody know what hoaxed stain is? Or DAPI, depending on what lab you work in. Stains the nucleus. The green is NuN, which stains neural cell bodies. And the red is GFAP, glial fibril acidic protein, which is a mark of glial cells. And you can see that there is increased density of these nuclei surrounding the electrode here, but not here. And why is that? We don't know. But maybe, I don't know if you can see, it may be too light in here, there are two blood vessels here and here that are not in this image, but there's one over here. And maybe that has something to do with it. We'll move towards that. And so these studies, the reason they haven't been done till about 5 years and ongoing now is that they're very laborious. You stick an electrode in the brain, you do a bunch of time series, you know, 1 day, 1 week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, a month. Then you very tediously slice the brain into very thin slices of 5 to 10 microns and do these triple stains. And anyone who's done immunohistochemistry knows how variable it can be. So interpreting the huge amount of data you get is difficult, though there are efforts at the Wadsworth Center in New York to do all this in an automated fashion. So what you can do is then label the cell nuclei and co-register them with neurons and then try to determine the density of neural elements, in this case around the main penetrating shank versus the wing where the electrode site is. And what did John discover? He discovered indeed that the density of non-neurons, of glial cells and astrocytes, was indeed much higher around the bigger shank, which kind of makes sense. If I had an infinitely small electrode, you would hypothesize that your immune response would go to nil. So the million-dollar question, of course, is how does this relate to electrophysiological function? Now that we've shown we have less immune response around the wing, does that result in increased unit activity? That's another hard experiment to do, which has yet to be done. But it should be done. Another way to reduce, potentially, the immune response or the insult to the brain is to make soft electrodes. Here's an example of the electrodes made out of polyimide, which is a soft polymer. Now, can anybody guess as to what the immediate problem is when you have a soft electrode? Yeah, how do you get a piece of wet spaghetti into a piece of fatty tissue and do it accurately and precisely? Well, one way you can do it, and this has really bogged down this field for years, is that many people have gotten PhDs and government grants and travel to conferences and do all that wonderful thing we scientists do. But no one's really solved this problem of you've made this wonderful polymer electrode, but how do we get it in the brain? Well, one way is to have it attached to something that's rigid, a carrier that you basically put it in together. But then you have the problem of when you remove this rigid thing, then doesn't the electrode come out with it due to static forces? So if you take advantage of hydrophobic interactions and carefully design the structure of this carrying knife, this is an example where they exploited the static holding the probes together, then they put a piece of artificial saline down the center, which caused them to peel away, and the electrode stayed in place. And I have a movie of this. So you can see the hard knife comes out and the soft electrode comes out with it. But now if you take advantage of that special coating that initially is static cling and then you remove it by putting saline between the layers, it goes away. So that's promising. We'll see if now then people can do the experiments and determine whether or not softer electrodes over the long term are better for long-term unit viability. okay, another way to get past the electrode problem is if you can't beat them, join them, in a way. So if my immune response is going to happen regardless of what I do, maybe I could design my electrode such that I try to get the highest density signals, the most modulating signals. Maybe I can insert it into a brain, if we're talking about neuroprosthetics, where I'll most likely get the highest yield of cells that are tuned to whatever task it is I'm trying to exploit. So in this case, this is for a motor neuroprosthetic, and my colleague Hirok put electrodes that span the entire motor cortex. Now you can see that you have 16 sites on here, but if the immune response is going to take away, let's just say, 50% of your cells, should you cluster your electrode sites in a fashion that you're where you're going to most likely get the most yield, even considering a neural response? So with a combination of histology and training of the rat on a task where he had to move left versus right, he determined that indeed the cells with the highest signal-to-noise ratio and the cells that are most likely to modulate with respect to his task were all in the deeper layers, which makes sense from what I told you beforehand, because in the motor cortex, there are these huge pyramidal cells that have these huge dipole fields that are very easy to record from. So if you were designing an electrode for a neuroprosthetic that you wanted to last a long time, instead of perhaps having the sites evenly spaced, you'd have maybe one or two here, so maybe you can pick up an independent neural source, and then a bunch clustered down here to get your largest dipole fields. Now you run the risk of, if you cluster your cells too closely together, maybe you'll start recording from the same neural sources and lose the total amount of information per electrode site compared to the others. But this is another consideration. Optimal electrode geometry and design is another way you could potentially solve the electrode problem. Another is to improve your signal processing. So if you're dealing with a noisy signal, software and real-time analysis has gotten powerful enough that perhaps we can try to remove noise sources. So even if the immune response is taking over, separating the neural sources, making them farther away from my electrode sites, perhaps I can play games and tweak my signal processing to try to get signal that was buried in the noise. And one way to do this is called common average referencing. Can anybody explain what that technique is? If I have a common signal, if you look in the middle, this is the raw signal, right? You can see that there appears to be some movement or some kind of noise-related artifact on the left side, but it seems to be correlated across the channels. So if I could somehow take the average of this correlation and subtract it from the neural signals, suddenly I'm able to extract spike waveforms. You can see up there, here, here, where previously they would have been buried in the noise. So signal processing improvements, another way we could get around the electrode problem. All these solutions are all incremental. I'd love to read in Science Magazine tomorrow that somebody at UM or MSU or any place in Michigan has found the magical drug that he can coat onto his electrode and he gets units forever. But it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. It's a complicated, subtle process of improving the performance of the electrode. I liken to it, because I'm from southeastern Michigan, to incremental improvements in the fuel economy. All right, another way of solving the electrode problem is, gee, why don't we coat our electrode sites with something that either prevents microglia astrocyte adhesion or reduces the impedance or allows you to deliver drugs. So I talked a little bit in the last lecture about stimulation, about how when you do stimulation experiments, you want the smallest electrode tip possible and the smallest impedance possible, which are mutually incompatible requirements. The smaller your electrode tip gets, the higher your impedance. One way around it, discovered here at UM, is to coat it with PDOT, which is an organic polymer that you can see it's black. They've coated gold sites with this PDOT polymer, making it fuzzy, in effect reducing the impedance of the electrode. And that's indeed what they do. You can see right here, these are a series of chronically implanted rats, and it's very nicely built into the experiment, the control, because this is a probe. You can see the P-dot sites and the normal sites all on the same electrode within the same animal. And so this is the 1 kilohertz impedance, which is most closely related to the spike discharge rate or the spike waveform. And so you can see in gray that the impedance, no argument here, is lower than the control sites. Now you notice that it was initially very, very low, like a quarter lower, 25% lower than the control sites. It was around 100 to 200K. And the problem with any kind of coding technique is even if you play games and you reduce the impedance down really, 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 really low, you're still going to get a layer of glial cells and astrocytes around your electrode, and that's going to contribute about 800K to your impedance. So even if you have an improvement of 100 to 20K, it doesn't matter because you're going to get 800K added because of the glial response. But nonetheless, even though the impedance went up to 1 meg, this is bad for stimulation experiments because you could get away with a quarter of the voltage than you would at 1 right here. It's still lower than the control sites. And there's this phenomenon discovered by Bell Labs called thermal noise that as the resistance of a circuit increases, the voltage due to the noise increases as a square of it. So if you can see where I have here is that if you have a 1 megaohm electrode, your voltage due to thermal noise is 10 microvolts, whereas for a 200 kiloohm electrode, it'll be about 5 microvolts. So if you can just reduce the noise floor of your electrodes, even if you have the immune response taking over, and even if your neural sources are farther away, if you can reduce the noise somehow, perhaps maybe you can see units that were there but buried in the noise, like I showed with that common average reference technique. And that is indeed what he saw, because it makes sense. If I reduce the impedance a little bit here from 2 to 1, I'm going to reduce my thermal noise, increasing, therefore, my signal noise ratio, which is the P-dot-coded sites and the control sites. So even though he coded the electrodes with this fancy organic polymer, the chief benefit was simply by reducing the impedance and reducing the thermal noise. There was no magic really about it, about how the coding, the neuron somehow liked it more and the immune response didn't take over. Though you can imagine if you coat or embed the P-dot with certain growth factors or steroids to reduce the immune response, maybe that will provide an additional benefit and increase the signal noise ratio even further. Those experiments have not been done yet. Now, I showed in this first series of data that even within an implant, and this is why the electrode problem just such a challenging one to solve, even within a same electrode, different shanks, you'll have a larger degree of immune response than on another shank. And I said before, you have this big blood vessel here and here. So maybe it has something to do with the bleeding. The problem is, you can certainly see the surface vasculature of the brain when you're doing your implantation, but you can't see the vasculature in the depths of the brain when you're implanting your electrodes. But maybe you can. Does anybody know what this machine is? The abbreviations are TPM. Yes. What kind of photon microscope? A 2-photon microscope. They have 3 now. But the 2-photon microscopy allows you to penetrate the depths of tissue down to 500 microns by shooting a tissue with two photons. When they hit a fluorophore, they'll cause one photon to be emitted. So it decreases the noise with regards to traditional photon microscopy. So what you could do is you take your little mouse, anesthetize them, and here we can see the vasculature. You see these surface vessels. But we really can't see inside the brain. And this is what normal photon microscopy would look like. We've injected the rat's bloodstream with FITC, which is a green fluorescent protein. And if you look closely, you can actually see individual blood vessels blood cells moving in the blood vessels. And also because the heart's beating, the change in blood pressure is why we're seeing this kind of pulsating in the image. But when we go to two photons, suddenly our signal noise ratio increases. So what you have is a scanning IR laser that's going down in stacks, in 5-micron stacks through tissue. So what you see here is the two photon image. These are the major surface vasculature vessels, and it's going to slowly go down to 500 microns. We're going deeper and deeper and deeper into the brain. It looks like a hare's nest. No wonder the electrode problem is so hard to solve when you're trying to avoid all these blood vessels that are bleeding into the brain that potentially are causing the inflammatory response we see. And perhaps the weird outlier that sometimes you see in an animal with unit activity lasting 6 months to a year is because you've perhaps managed to avoid major vasculature. Now you can see there's no way of avoiding these small capillaries. They're just everywhere. But if you look closely, it appears that there are these larger vessels that dive down straight perpendicularly into the tissue. Let's collapse all these stacks. So here we go. I took all 5-micron steps in the 500-micron image and squished them. So you can see the surface vasculature here. This is 700 microns by 700 microns on the side. And so you can see that there's capillaries all over the place. But about every 200 to 300 microns, there are these larger vessels that dive down perpendicularly into the surface of the brain, into the cortex. And they're spaced appropriately enough, 200 to 300 microns, that with the electrodes most people often use, one or two to eight shanks spaced by 100 to 200 microns, perhaps out of every 20 animals, you just happen to avoid these major vessels. And that's why you can get the unit activity for up to a year. Now, to show you more what the structure of the vasculature in the neocortex is, this is a 3D reconstruction. Let's see if I turn on all the lights for this. So you can see that this is the top over here, and then you see these perpendicular diving vessels going down to the depths of the cortex. So there are the surface vessels. Now we're going to turn it on a side. And you see all these diving vessels and then the huge capillary beds. Now here's the problem. With two-photon imaging, I can definitely see these diving vessels. And it may be possible for me, using a standard stereotactic manipulator, to insert my electrode such that it avoids those major diving vessels. But you can see there's a slight clearance problem here. And if we really want this to work in a clinical setting, it may be hard to put a human underneath this microscope to see the vessels. Now, this is a 3D image of the electrode in. And so you can see, even with one electrode, there's a slight, see how there's a compression of the tissue. See how it's kind of going down like that during insertion. And so you have blunt insertion trauma on the vasculature itself here. But maybe this can still help the electrode problem. Because in this experiment, what we did is we looked at the image on a dissection scope, made the very nice high-resolution map, determined where the diving vessels were versus the safe zones, took the animal out, and then inserted electrodes based on surface landmarks. So you can see this electrode right here is right on the side of a surface artery, but it's not breaching it, is just right on the side, no bleeding. This electrode here appears to be in a perfectly safe place, no major vessels, but he caused a bleeding response because he targeted one of those vessels that go down and at an angle. So he was specifically targeting an artery that you could not see without two-photon microscopy. So you can see right here, this is before electrode insertion. So you can see the nice capillaries. See, right here. And then after you insert the electrode, it looks fine over here, but once we turn it onto the backside, you'll see a lack of signal. See how it almost looks like a hollow pocket now inside? Because the bleeding is now bleeding into the cortex, and you cannot see the vessels anymore because the blood is no longer defined because it's now just a massive diffuse cloud in the region where you inserted the electrode. Now, you can see that there are a certain number of areas surrounding each of these vessels. So maybe we can perhaps build some confidence interval zones around the electrodes, around the vessels we see, based on this two-photon, to set up a series of rules for if you don't have access to a two-photon microscope, set up a series of rules for doing your implantation, that you want to be within 200 or 300 microns away from any of these surface vessels, and you have a 50% probability of not hitting a diving one or something like that. Now, the killer experiment, again, these are hard experiments to do, is to actually image this rat, image the mouse, insert the electrodes such that a couple shanks hit the vessels and a couple do not. The hypothesis is that the shanks that hit the vessels will have reduced unit activity, whereas the shanks that do not will have increased unit activity. And that experiment has not been done yet, but it'd be interesting to see what happens. So that's it. This is a short lecture on the electrode problem because, like I said, we still do not know how to solve it. And there are a number of things people are trying here and at other institutions, incremental improvements in the technology that may, hopefully, if you have enough of these, 20 to 25 improvements, then the long-term goal of a 10-year implant that can record unit activity its whole lifetime can then become a possibility. So we'll take a short break. We'll try to get this experiment working, and then we'll close the class talking about neuroprosthetics.